Welcome to Difficult Heritage. In this show, we will talk about monuments and bodies in post-fascist and post-colonial Italy.
It is a show part of Uncivil Society, discursive bodies in right-wing spaces, a performative radio day to explore international and global phenomena of right-wing radicalism. This is Carola Haupt.
And I am Ilaria Gardens.
And we are Radio Papesse, a web radio and audio archive devoted to contemporary art. You can find us on radiopapesse.org and in Florence. But the show is not about us, and we won't be alone in this journey into Italy's difficult heritage. So, without any further ado, let us introduce our first guest, Esper Postma.
I'm Esper Postma. I'm a visual artist from the Netherlands. I'm right now in my apartment in Berlin.
We met him last year in Florence, where he was invited for an artist research fellowship by Villa Romana and Kunsthistorisches Institut in Florence, Max Planck Institute.
Esper's work unravels the narratives that make up our cultural identity as told by political and cultural institutions. And in Italy, he has critically engaged in the ongoing debate on the legacy of the fascist regime, focusing on the agency of fascist art in public space.
I was interested in what was left from the fascist regime. And in Rome, there's just the most built under the fascist regime and the most left. And they were doing that to sort of compete with other historical buildings, such as Roman architectural history, which of course left a huge mark on the landscape. For the fascist regime, building a lot there was a way of projecting themselves into eternity and sort of making their own mark on the landscape.
So, Rome. This is where we start. La città eterna, Roma capoccia, Roma caput mundi, an intricate bundle of vices and virtues, visions and nightmares.
So what I find interesting of Rome is how it's incredibly layered in these histories that definitely also influence each other. A lot of the fascist architecture is inspired on ancient Roman architecture, for instance.
Are you familiar with Foro Italico? Inspired by the Roman forums of the Imperial Age, Foro Italico is a bold example of Italian fascist architecture. You might have seen it in black and white images or archive footage of the 1960 Summer Olympics, when, against all odds, Abebe Bikila won the marathon running barefoot.
Dopo 10 chilometri è in prima fila Bikila Abebe, etiopico. Arriva solo a Porta San Sebastiano. È ancora solo al 40esimo chilometro in vista dell'Arco di Costantino.
Bikila was one of the only a few Ethiopian athletes in Rome. And along the race route, he had run twice by the Axum Obelisk, brought to Rome by Mussolini from Ethiopia in 1937 as a symbol of the Italian conquest and the imperial ambitions of fascism.
L'obelisco di Axum, il tredicesimo monumento che attraverso i secoli Roma ha portato nella sua cinta augustea dalle terre d'Africa, inaugurata nella piazza di Porta Capena.
At the Foro Italico, which is a sports complex that was built in the 1930s, and that was initially called Foro Mussolini, there's a walkway with black and white mosaics. And these mosaics show athletes practicing different kinds of sports, but they also show many other motifs of labor and of technology, of Roman mythology, colonial war. And they're also mixed with fascist slogans and signs.
The interaction between fascist mottos and black and white figures engaged in athletic activities conveyed the message that sport would not merely strengthen bodies, but also would prepare them for military conquest.
And to my surprise, I saw people practicing sports on top of the mosaics. when I was there, there was a fitness class. Kids were playing soccer. There were people on stunt bikes. And I thought it was really interesting that these people were mirroring the images in the mosaics. By doing so, interacting with their own past in a way. So I made snapshots with my phone, but of course these weren't so convincing because it's hard to photograph the mosaics from the ground. And later I realized that the images would have to be taken from the air.
And the result is a series of aerial photographs, memory games.
So the aerial view is a way to see human bodies interacting with the mosaics and merging with the mosaics. And also their shadows literally merge with the images. It becomes sometimes hard to distinct the images from the shadows. So the images are a symbolic way of seeing where past and present can come together and how we can unconsciously still interact with the past and are influenced by the past.
There is this fascinating and slightly confusing ambivalence in the overlapping and visual continuity between the real bodies in flesh and bones, their shadows and the silhouette in the fascist mosaics.
Questa ambivalenza si costruisce attraverso un comune denominatore che è lo sport.
Sport is really the foundation of this ambivalence. Despite the post-war break with fascism, this space is not only still in use, but serves the same purpose as a sports complex.
Ma in realtà si è creata una continuità restituendo la stessa funzione a questo spazio e infatti vediamo.
This line of continuity is central to what we call uncomfortable heritage. And it's central to any cultural debate around it, since Rome got its chance to stage the Olympic Games in 1960.
Uncomfortable heritage, come l'abbiamo definito.
Carmen Belmonte is a postdoctoral researcher at the Kunsthistorisches Institut in Florence. And her research focuses on the visual culture and legacy of Italian colonialism and fascism. We met Carmen in her office, where we talked about Esper's work, the material legacy of fascist cultural heritage, and about how, among the many different approaches to cultural heritage in countries that face dictatorships, Italy has mainly adopted reuse and conservation.
So, as we were saying, Carmen Belmonte worked with Esper Posma, and she wrote about his work, pointing out the way he focuses on the agency of fascist art in public space.
Dobbiamo interrogarci quanto
we have to ask ourselves to what extent this aesthetic influences the younger generations, to what extent they take its neutrality for granted, or whether they relate this aesthetic to a fascist project, which is a racist project.
Un progetto specifico fascista che è poi anche un progetto razzista. Quanto questo culto del corpo della salute.
It's legitimate to ask ourselves how the cult of the body, of masculinity that emerges from these iconographies, can be appealing to these young people who play sports today.
Questi gruppi che praticano sport oggi.
A change of scenery. We are still in Rome, but in another area. The Eur district was planned in 1942 to host the Esposizione Universale. Here, the so-called Square Colosseum, one of the most iconic modern Roman buildings, still bears an inscription from the speech with which Mussolini announced the invasion of Ethiopia, and in which he described Italians as a nation of poets, of artists, of heroes, of saints, of thinkers, scientists, of navigators and migrators.
And not far from there, Esper Posma bumped into a bronze sculpture.
So I was walking around the EUR in Rome. So I just bumped into him. And it's a tall bronze statue of 5 meters, I would say, placed on a cylindrical pedestal. And he is a Roman-looking guy. He's naked, except for a leaf covering his genitals and a laurel crown on his head. And he's making the fascist salute, which is of course the same as the Roman salute. And on his hands he wears something that is hard to recognize, but I later learned that they're ancient Roman boxing gloves. And I learned that after the war, they were added in an attempt to change the meaning of the sculpture. They also changed the title of the statue from Genius of Fascism to Genius of Sport. It's a very poor camouflage. It's very clear that it's a fascist sculpture. But then it's also, it's a bit obscure and contradictive because it says Genius of Sport while it's making this fascist salute. So that was what interested me.
C'è stata una cesura con la caduta del fascismo e c'è stata l'esigenza, si è sentita l'esigenza di rimuovere i più eclatanti simboli del potere fascista.
With the fall of fascism, its symbols were removed. But at the same time, Italy was a country that needed to be rebuilt, but it also needed the many buildings, especially the institutional ones, that were built during Mussolini's regime. That's why strategies of reuse and conservation were adopted.
E quindi furono adottate delle strategie che puntavano in qualche modo alla conservazione e al riuso. Per esempio, nel 1944 fu emanata una circolare dal Ministero della Pubblica Istruzione che diceva di rimuovere tutte le insegne, i simboli fascisti dagli edifici pubblici.
E questo in 1944, the Ministry of Education ordered the removal of fascist signs and symbols from all public buildings. At first, it was a mass emotional outburst, but the ministry also specified that in the case of buildings, they should not be damaged. For instance, Mario Sironi's mural in the Aula Magna of the Sapienza University was covered with a glued paper. In other cases, curtains were used to cover up the past.
In modo di coprire i simboli più espliciti, ma nello stesso tempo di poter riutilizzare l'edificio. In questa cornice è possibile inserire il camuflaggio.
The camouflage of Italo Griselli's Genius of Fascism that became the Genius of Sport also fits into this framework.
The box.
So the effect is that monuments are in an identity crisis. So they're torn between their fascist and their democratic identity. The genius is a good example because the solution of adding the cesti, the boxing gloves, is ironic because the cesti are a very violent object. So they were boxing gloves that were made of metal in order to cause more damage. And besides that, boxing was a sport that was most popularized under the regime. So I see the statue as symbolic for the way that Italy is still haunted by its fascist past.
And while Italy is haunted by its past, Carmen Belmonte tells us we should consider the power the past holds over people and how contemporary Italy is absorbing or neutralizing its aesthetics. Meanwhile, Esper tries to think with the monuments.
I try to reason from the monument instead of from the public. I try to think of the life of a monument as an actual life and try to imagine what they go through. And I take it a step further by attributing human qualities to monuments and speak of their transformations as actions.
He recently wrote an essay we suggest you to read, Doppelgangers, The Double Lives of Monuments.
Basically, the doppelganger is a creative way of exploring the complexities of human psychology. So I wanted to use the motive for monuments as a way of identifying with them, of analyzing their complexities, to analyze the ways that they can be altered over time and or how their interpretation can change. Monuments can even be destroyed and return as their double. So they become reconstructed, such as some buildings right now in Germany, like the Humboldt Forum. And in the case of the genius of fascism, it is a way of considering his new form as a double who represses his violent past, but doesn't really manage to fully repress it.
We asked Carmen the same question Ruth Ben-Ghiad asked from the pages of the New Yorker a few years ago. It was 2017. Why are so many fascist monuments still standing in Italy? Why, among the many possible approaches to our fascist heritage, did we adopt reuse and conservation?
Dobbiamo tenere in considerazione che l'Italia ha avuto sempre una forte tradizione di tutela e conservazione.
Italy has a long tradition of preservation, a strong awareness of its cultural heritage as historical evidence.
Opere, monumenti come testimonianze storiche. E infatti, non a caso, il momento in cui...
The 1980s are a crucial time, because according to the law of 1939, 50 years after it's being built, a work is to be inspected and eventually placed under a protection order. The 1980s are the time when these works actually become part of the national cultural heritage.
Questo è il momento in cui queste opere d'arte entrano di fatto a far parte del patrimonio culturale nazionale. In realtà possono esserci tantissime strade diverse da imboccare.
Among the conservation strategies, musealization is an option and contemporary art can help as well.
D'aiuto può essere proprio l'arte contemporanea.
It's the case of Arnold Holzknecht and Michele Bernardi's installation in Bolzano that overwrites Hans Pifrard's fascist propaganda bas-relief, Il Trionfo del Fascismo, on the facade of the former Casa Littoria.
Una forte connotazione politica, una forte connotazione di propaganda fascista. In quel caso, l'opera è stata effettivamente
conservata. Their site-specific installation consists of a white LED light inscription along the length of the relief. You can read, "No one has the right to obey," in Latin, German and Italian. It quotes Hannah Arendt to counter and deconstruct the fascist message, "Believe, obey, fight," of Pifrada's homage to Mussolini.
A decostruire il messaggio e il potenziale del messaggio del monumento fascista.
To find out how the Italian way to conservation comes to terms with the last years of international debate around the removal of monuments and symbols of oppression and discrimination, we have to look back at our colonial past.
Dobbiamo tornare un attimo un po' più indietro al 2017, quindi prima delle proteste del movimento Black Lives Matter.
We have to go back to 2017, because after what happened in Charlottesville, in the US, after the removal of Confederate monuments and the resulting white supremacist rally, a debate had begun in Italy too, about fascist cultural heritage. Many scholars focused on the fact that preservation can trigger further reflections, while censorship comes with a risk of removal. And I share this concern.
Garantire poi anche una riflessione successiva, mentre la censura può essere anche un grave rischio di rimozione, e condivido in effetti questa riflessione. E credo che per quanto riguarda invece il 2020, tutto ciò che poi è successo a partire dal 2020...
Coming to 2020, the Black Lives Matter movement has triggered in Italy an unprecedented debate on its colonial heritage. Among the statues that have been pulled down around the world, in Italy, the one under attack was that of journalist Indro Montanelli in Milan.
While serving in the army in 1935 and 1936 during Italy's war in Eritrea, the 26-year-old Montanelli bought and married a 12-year-old girl.
Ed è interessante pensare...
What is interesting is that Montanelli's statue is a contemporary monument. It's not part of the historical heritage. But this is a crucial moment in which contemporary Italy is beginning to question what the symbols, monuments, and figures are that can represent it.
quali sono I simboli, quali sono I
What we are facing is no longer a debate on historical heritage, but it has to do with the memory Italy wants to hand down.
Storico, ma è una questione che riguarda la memoria che oggi l'Italia vuole tramandare.
So, as Carmen Belmonte reminded us, the question about what kind of memories we choose to pass on is crucial in discussing the ways in which the colonial heritage has been approached, handled, and represented. A cultural debate in which unspoken racial colonial legacy are still casting their shadow.
And one of the most relevant voices in this discussion belongs to Angelica Pesarini.
So I'm Angelica Pesarini. I'm an assistant professor in race and cultural studies, race and diaspora, and Italian studies at the University of Toronto.
And that's where we caught up with her. In 2021, together with historian Carla Panico, Angelica Pesarini published an article titled From Colston to Montanelli, Public Memory and Counter Monuments in the Era of Black Lives Matter. And it is a highly suggested reading, by the way. In this paper, they remark how much shared narratives of the colonial past are weighted down by what they define white ignorance. Where white refers to the selective exclusion of certain historical facts from collective memory as the result of centuries of colonial and race domination. With the consequence that only certain forms of knowledge and ways of remembering have been deemed as the valid ones.
And as an Italian Black woman, Angelica Pesarini can't help but raise questions about the perception of Black bodies into our contemporary society. And in order to do so, she believes that it is important to critically approach our shared knowledge system, to look at the Italian colonial past, how we talk about it and what we teach of it. All of that is what she calls to re-signify knowledge.
Obviously, I also start from my own position, and I felt since I was young, but I realized this as an adult, a sort of epistemological discomfort. So there was a sort of family archive in which I could hear stories. And then there is a sort of institutional archive that in which these stories were erased and people like me or my grandmothers did not exist, apparently. And so this idea of knowledge has always been very important for me because I realized through academia, through education, how ignorant I was and how I've never been taught about colonialism in school. It was always a very short parenthesis. In reality, when you study Italian colonialism, the crime, the violence, but also the resistance, you realize that there are many missing stories.
To re-signify knowledge means this, to broaden the spectrum and also to include knowledge produced by marginalized groups.
I've been always quite interested in the racialization of the political discourse on immigration in Italy, especially in relation to what I witnessed in 2018. So 2018 was a very difficult year, I think, in general, especially for Black people and people of color, because there was an incredible amount of violence that was expressed against and performed against our bodies.
It started out February that year with the actions of Luca Traini, a neo-fascist and white suprematist who set out on a killing spree in the town of Macerata, targeting migrants and shooting six people. Just 1 month later, in Firenze, Ididien, a Senegalese-born man, was killed while crossing a bridge by a man who claimed to have shot the first person he met.
CCTV showed that actually many people passed that bridge when it was there, and the only dead body is a Black body. And so that was very disturbing for me because I always wonder, you know, what about if I was there, right? And you can see how your cultural capital, the fact I'm Italian, I have an Italian surname and name, I have an Italian passport, all of this doesn't matter because what counts is your body.
A black body. And to talk about black bodies and their position into Italian contemporary society necessarily means to talk about racial issues and privilege.
And also there is this connection with whiteness, which is very interesting. So even abroad, to be Italian is to be white, because this is what we portray about Italy. So rightly, people don't see Italians of color or black Italian being represented. And so there is this internalized image of Italy as the land of poets and sailors, which is also interesting because that is a very fascist legacy. People sometimes tell me, but this is not us. You know, this is, we are not racist because we don't have race. We don't mention the word race. So how can we be racist? So it's interesting how there is a lot of denial and there is this internalized idea that to be Italian is to be white. So it's a really a historical legacy. So how Italianness has been conceived and how whiteness has been, what the role of whiteness in that. And I think we have to go before fascism.
More precisely, we have to go back to the beginning of the Italian colonial endeavors and the occupation of Eritrea in 1890. 20 years later, due to the great number of mixed-race children, when the civil code for the Eritrean colony was enacted in 1909, there were stated for the first time the criteria to establish citizenship.
And already from there, we see how Italianness is transmitted using biological criteria. They say that citizenship, Italian citizenship, can be transmitted to someone born in the colonies by an unknown father if they show the sign of the white race. But also you had to be Christian and you needed to have a certain level of education. So it's interesting how whiteness and blood have been, in my opinion, fundamental pieces of Italian identity. And still today, you know, when people who are non-white, like in my case, when I say I'm Italian, and sometimes I may hear a question like, oh, ma, you don't look like it, or no, but where are you really from, right? So why are these questions asked? Precisely because of that, because people, we have a pre-racial knowledge of the other that's been taught to us. And so certain bodies, as Nirmal Puwar says, are dissonant body. They create confusion. And so they need to be labeled.
Nirmal Puwar is a professor at the Department of Sociology at Goldsmiths University in the UK.
And in her book, Space Invaders, Race, Gender and Bodies Out of Space, she asks what happens when certain bodies, like marginalized communities, bodies that are not expected to occupy specific places, what happens when they do so?
She points out how the moment when the excluded are included becomes incredibly revealing, and how, for example, the position and the posture of a black body in a privileged public space may provoke some sort of uneasiness.
Concepts like white privilege is very, make people in Italy extremely uncomfortable, because you mentioned, first of all, whiteness. So you are racially defined, and this creates a lot of discomfort, because in Europe, we don't talk about race. Or when you talk about race, people immediately think about, you know, biological race. And not thinking about the socio-economic, political dimension of this word. So we know that race and races do not exist scientifically, but this word and this concept has been invented, and the implications are still alive today. However, I think certain concepts are very important, you know, the idea of positionality. People in Italy are very often unable to position themselves as white subjects, and they're unable to see the privileges that come with that.
And exactly the position and materialization of the black body in the Italian context is at the core of an ongoing dialogue between Angelica Pesarini and artist Binta Diao that in 2020 took the form of Nero Sangue, an exhibition at the Museum of Gallarate in Milan.
I'm so happy to join you in this conversation. And
so here is Binta.
Yes, about Nero Sangue. So Nero Sangue is a project that I started in during my studies in France. So I moved to France from Milan for my master. There I started a research about a magazine called La Difesa della Razza.
Let us open a quick parenthesis here. La Difesa della Razza was an official magazine of the fascist regime, published between 1938 and 1943. It was one of the many tools of Italian racist propaganda, and it had the explicit mandate to promote supposedly scientific idea to affirm the superiority of the Italian fascist race.
La Difesa della Razza, where I found a lot of images of no white bodies exploited and used as objects, you know, to justify, you know, racist theories, etc. So when I found this material, I directly linked, you know, this form of exploitation to the new form of exploitation, of bodily exploitation in Italy.
The idea was to theorize a bit this idea of the black body and the production, the materialization of the black body in the Italian context. I did some research, you know, in Florence at the former Istituto Agronomico per l'Oltremare, where there is a wonderful archive and catalogs of images coming from Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia. And it was really fascinating to see how black subjects were portrayed there, so always sat on the floor in nature, so they were really part of the flora and fauna that belonged to the Italians. And so sometimes you struggle to recognize a body from a tree, because there is this idea that they're all one thing, immersed in nature, or they are portrayed from behind and surrounded by cattle. And so this obviously was made to portray the white Italian race as a superior.
With the Nero Sangue exhibition, Binta Diao and Angelica Pesarini reflected on the exploitation of the black body. In particular, they investigated the labor in tomato fields in Italy, performed mainly by black migrants, in connection to highly exploitative and racialized forms of work that reflect practices of modern slavery.
In the piece that gives the title to the exhibition, Nero Sangue, Binta transferred on fabric a series of images selected from La Difesa della Razza. And then she put these in relation with a couple of tomatoes, real tomatoes.
These tomatoes are not red as normal tomatoes, but as standard tomatoes, but are black. Because I colored them actually in black, because I wanted to highlight actually the connection between the tomatoes and the black body, actually. Basically, I was thinking about how spending all the day from the morning, from the early morning to the evening in plantation creates a sort of organic relationship, no, between the body and also the plants, no, the vegetables.
Nero Sangue literally means black blood, a blood that seems to be one of the connecting elements between those representation of racialized bodies in La Difesa della Razza and the blood that is shed by the black bodies bent in the fields picking tomatoes.
The truth was
the sheep sailed.
The rain came.
The loss arose.
The truth is, The ship sailed.
The rains came.
The ship sailed.
The
rains came.
The
loss arose. The
loss need not to be proved.
The Negro
is another ground. Is not necessary.
This is
appeared impossible.
Was
decided.
Not should be.
Has been decided.
Should not be. Is.
It is said.
This is Radio Papesse, and you are listening to Difficult Heritage, Doppelgangers and Dissonant Bodies in Post-Fascist and Post-Colonial Italy.
What we are listening to is a fragment from Chorus Zong, a sound work by Binta Diao and presented as part of the Nero Sangue exhibition.
Up until now, we've been talking about monuments and bodies in post-fascist and post-colonial Italy, about the weight of the fascist heritage, spoken and unspoken, in contemporary society, and about how shared narratives inform the position and perception of Black bodies.
So let's go back to Binta Diao.
I'm an artist, I'm a Black woman, Black Italian woman. For me, being an artist is a responsibility because when I create something, my aim actually is to touch also other people, you know, in particular, you know, people from my community, you know, from minority, you know, minorities. And being an artist is actually, it's a privilege because you can say things in a different way. And also you can enter in very complicated spaces, you know. It's a privilege, you know, to be in an institution and talk about real problems, you know.
That is exactly what happened with A Living Experience of Feeling Listened, a series of participatory actions Binta set in place during a residency at Lungomare Bolzano in 2020.
The main inspiration for the project was the text Südtirol ABC su Tirolo by Alexander Langer, based on a list of keywords which the author thought of as a language to be able to narrate and describe the past and the reality of South Tirol as his time.
Basically, Langer was talking about the fighting, you know, between Italians and, you know, and the German side, etc. But for me, it was very important because to focus on minorities. I organized three workshops in which I asked for a specific participation. And for each workshop, I choose, you know, specific words. And basically, these keywords were the starting point also of our conversation.
The first collective practice, called The Land of Our Birth is a Woman, included the drafting and realization of a collective patchwork. The chosen keywords were fear, taking sides, marginalized body, and mixture. The second one revolved around food, and a collective potluck was organized. The chosen keywords in this case were assimilation, ethnicity, mixing, nature, and the right of home, the right of living. While the third and last collective practice involved second generation Italians, and it was called Living Young, Wild and Free.
And yeah, I love the way they open up, you know, the discussions about all these themes, no? So being a marginalized body, you know, how they used to push all this discourse and how they fight, you know, for their identities through, for example, music, you know. And when you give them the tools, they can continue. And they feel also a sort of responsibility, no?
What came out from the encounters of a living experience of feeling listened, the sewing, the images, the videos, sounds, ended up in an exhibition that negotiated cultural identification, social participation, as well as the democratic constitution of Südtirol.
So, if Alexander Langer's ABC Südtirol challenged his readers to question the limited view of the world, Binta Diao responded to his call to action, inviting the participants in the collective practice to take responsibility and imagine strategies for the future.
And a similar invite lies into Angelica Pesarini's prompt to resignify our collective knowledge, broadening the public discourse to marginalized and dissonant bodies.
And in Carmen Belmonte's invitation to be aware of the repercussions of our relations with the material and cultural heritage left behind by the fascist regime.
And as well as in Esper Postma's focus in unraveling the narratives that make up our cultural identity as told by political and cultural institutions. This has been our journey into difficult heritage, doppelgangers and dissonant bodies in post-fascist and post-colonial Italy. We hope you enjoyed listening.
And before saying goodbye, we need to thank Esper Posma, Carmen Belmonte, Angelica Pesarini and Binta Diao.
And all the ecosystem and the people that allowed us to get to know them. So Villa Romana, Black History Month Firenze, the Kunsthistorisches Institut Florence, and in particular, Angelica Stepken, Justin Randolph Thompson, Simone Frangi, and many, many others.
And thanks to Radio 80,000 and the Goethe Institute for inviting us to contribute to uncivil society discursive bodies in right-wing spaces.
And lastly, thank you all for listening.
This is Radio Pavese, over and out.